Hey team, things are going to look a little different coming up. But this is a good thing. Sometimes change is hard, and it's something that we have been working on in the background for a little while now. Honestly, change is good. It's the whole reason Hamish and I started the podcast, and we feel the building industry needs it. Oh, and by the way, I'm Matt, Hamish's co-host who loves to poke the bear. But what's cool is we are now recording from the Pro Climber Australia Studios, who are our major sponsor of our podcast. It's like the perfect combination. We're kind of like Batman and Robin fighting the crime against an outdated, crappy building industry. With a perfect combination of pushing boundaries, sharing our knowledge, and starting real conversation about how we can improve the industry. Of course, I'm Batman, and really, Hamish is a little bit more like Alfred. Anyway, enjoy today's episode, which is coming directly from the Pro Climber Built to Last studio. Welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Builder. We're recording here at Hit V Hype in the Pro Climber studio, the Built to Last studio. So I'm here with my good friend Hamish, my co-host, but I'm also here with Rob. And I actually met Rob just as COVID had started.
Yeah.
And Rob had reached out to me to build his house in Altona. Cool story, because the house didn't get built, and I don't mean that in a bad way.
But it's a sucker.
Yeah, but it's a kind of cool. What I like about it is
it's so cool. You didn't get your house built.
But we'll get to this. But what I like, the fact that why we didn't build it, is because you actually made a decision not to build it, rather than I see so many people just keep stretching and stretching and then just pulling themselves into this world of like stress. Were you very confident, like, we just can't do this, and that is an awesome outcome?
Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, from my perspective as the builder.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're totally right. It was disappointing and sad that we didn't get there. But it was definitely the good decision, because we would have been in such a financial hardship now, but also we wouldn't have actually been able to go past the past the design stages anyway.
Yeah.
It was a cool design. It was like fucking cool.
Yeah. It was an interesting design. It started very ambitious and then got scaled back. You probably remember that.
But it was affordable though at the start. So pre-COVID, like, the numbers worked. Like, it was like, yeah, sweet. So it was the perfect, like, hey, let's just reprice this because of COVID. And it was...
Yes. And it took a long time as well to go past council, so that obviously...
So you're pretty well progressed with the design, so through council.
We obtained planning permit.
Yeah, you got a covenant removed from memory.
I think I'm totally on board. Like, it's good that we didn't build it. Yeah. And if I think back at it, probably I pushed a little bit longer than what I should have. I think that I went out to market with other builders. I sort of, I still believed that we could build it for what the budget was, while probably maybe in you had it already. Like,
no, I think that's a good,
be built.
But that's the best outcome. Like, that is like you tested the waters, you saw what was there, it didn't work. You tested some more waters. Like, you got to throw things at the project, but you don't have to be stupid. And hey, what I see constantly is people in your position go, "Nah, I'll be fine." Like, "Nah, that budget mustn't be right. We'll get there. Don't worry." But they keep progressing. They get to the end, and then the number's still the same. And they're like, "But why is it so expensive?" Mm-hmm. And they've just spent $100,000 on design fees, consultant fees, and now they can't build the house.
Yeah, I think it's hard to shut down a dream sometimes.
Yeah,
And I think that's just that sings true to so many people who just keep pushing and pushing and hoping for the best. Like, I think I don't know how many times you've said it, but getting a builder on board and the team involved and from the very, very beginning is the way to go. Yeah, but you've got this unfortunate, situation of COVID that no one could have predicted.
But it still happens now, and I think that's the beauty of it. That's the reason why we do it. And I actually had a client yesterday pull the pin on a project, and I was like, this is a weird email to write. And I actually wrote it this morning. I'm like, this is what I want to hear from you. Like, the reason why we test the budget early and was the budget meets brief, in this case it didn't by a huge amount,
they didn't go, oh, hopefully we can get there. No, they had the courage to be like, no, we're not doing this. And I think that is like something that it's not sexy. You can't put on Instagram. You can't talk about that on social media because it's the job that you didn't win and then you perceived it too expensive. I've encouraged them to maybe get a few other market quotes, but the reality is I got two estimators to price this.
Yeah.
And so I didn't even price it. The market rate is dictated by them and what their billions of dollars of estimation per year. So that's what they're going to get.
I mean, it's probably not exactly what we're going to talk about with Robert, and I'm going to get to Robert in a sec, but I had exactly the same conversation with someone last night where they've come to me, gone through planning. I'm like, you're probably $600,000 off where it's going to be. She goes, oh, okay, well, what happens if you don't build it like this? And I'm like, it's still, it's like, it's the size of the home. It's 275 square meters. And I think you've been misled by your architect here. I'm sorry. Anyway, Robert, who are you? And
I was literally about to ask that question. What, I was like, that's going to be my leeway.
What are you, why are you sitting here? What's your role with, and there's an accent there as well.
Yes.
So,
can you guess?
Well, I know it's Italian.
I know.
Yeah, you're wrong.
Oh, right.
not totally wrong. My family's from Italy, but I was born and raised in Switzerland. In the Italian part of Switzerland.
Yeah, but you speak...
My first language is Italian.
Is it the sexiest accent we've had on the podcast so far?
Because Switzerland's this sort of interesting mesh of German and Italy. Don't you have two national languages?
We have four.
Okay, of course.
And so you're up the... I'm assuming like around the Como region, up that part?
Yeah. So Como obviously is in Italy, but it's...
Across the border,
and probably half an hour drive from Como.
And do you speak all the four national languages?
Probably speak six.
No. I used to. Obviously, at school, we need to learn German and French, plus obviously the language of the canton that you live in, so Italian. And when I was at school, I learned all those. But now it's been so long that I haven't practiced my German and French. I can probably understand a little bit, but I would find it very difficult. Yeah.
Can you still read German, considering you live in PHPP?
No. No. French, yes. Not German. German.
So you come over here in 2009, is that right?
Yeah, 2009.
And how did you get into the space that you're working in now?
It was pretty much by chance. So, came in 2009, started my bachelor in social science with a major in environmental management. And during the first or second year of uni, I got myself a job for a consultancy that used to do energy audits on existing buildings for local governments. So I got the job and slowly became somewhat passionate about buildings and how they perform and what can be done to make them better.
Yep.
And then from there, I got more into the specific ESD space, or rather than looking at existing building, looking at the design stages.
And when I met you, you weren't at HitV Hype, I think. Is that correct? Or just started?
No, I wasn't at HitV Hype at that time. So at that time, I was at Sustainable Built Environments, which is a dedicated ESD consultancy, which is part of the Pedaltorp group, Pedaltorp Architects. So at the time, it was probably the only ESD consultancy that was integrated in an architectural firm, which was pretty good because you actually had the opportunity to influence design very early on. Sometime as ESD consultant here, we get onto the project when the building form is already sort of set. There is already like an approved scheme, which for a lot of things is already difficult then to make improvement because
it's like costing a project when the design's already completely developed. It's hard to.
What are you talking about? We never do that.
So for those who don't know, what does ESD stand for?
Environmentally sustainable design.
Yep.
Isn't everything sustainably designed though, or claims to be right now?
I guess so.
So what would you say your role is in a building? Like what are you bringing to that team of consultants?
Good question.
Very good question, Amish.
It is.
Thank you.
Well, your question game today.
Yep.
It really depends a little bit on the project. Now here at VIP, we are somewhat fortunate because we do tend to work with clients that have high sustainability ambitions, and therefore we don't just do minimum compliance work or, you know, checks, your Section J, your NATO's minimum compliance report. So our role really is to, if we start from concept design, is to try and set the ambitions and the framework for sustainability.
And what's an example? Park life, for example, what might those some of those criteria be?
Well, it could be like things like what do we want to achieve in terms of thermal performance? And we speak about, for Park Life too, for example, about NATO's ratings,
yes.
What NATO's rating we want to achieve, what some of the indoor environment qualities that we want to bring in, like, you know, what materials do we want to work with, all the way down to, you know, what our target for potable water reductions or stormwater treatment. Or
energy generation. Yeah. Waste management?
Waste, a little bit.
And do you have, say, I mean, Park Life's about to go into construction. Is there, I guess, some criteria that the build team needs to adhere to from, say, waste management point of view? Is there some goals or KPIs that you're setting within their contract?
Well, yeah, essentially that becomes part of the building permit stage. So, you know, you need to go through a planning process with council. So a lot of council required a sustainability management plan as part of the application. And that sets the initiatives and targets that the developer is going to achieve from a sustainability point of view.
Do you think those things that councillor do is just greenwashing? So I know when I did mine, they were more focused on a bike at my own residential house and like the fact that we were going passive house certification and adding, like there was not even a tick box for improving the north face glazing or HRV or we're going to be...
How are you going to charge your electric car?
Through a plug?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. No, like, but like, there should be some...
No, but like it was more worried about like some of the... I can't even remember if like... It was some of the stuff I had on there, but I remember having to pay for this stupid report and I actually called James, like, what the fuck is this? Like, I just wasted a few hundred dollars on what I would call the biggest piece of shit of document I've ever had to look at. Like, it was purely a government tick box that they had done to go through a planning process, but it ignored all what I would consider the most valuable things that you should look in a building.
Okay, I'm going to challenge that for a second though, because I think you need some kind of basic framework that everyone deals with. I mean,
isn't that NatHERS?
Yeah, but you're an outlier with what you're trying to build there.
I know, but isn't that NatHERS that every project per the NCC at that time would have had to met a 6-star? Why do we need it? Like, why add another layer? They were worried about like water consumption that I had 5,000 litres and I something was something like, and I can't quite remember exactly, but it's like, oh, you got... But so I ticked the 2,000 litre, but it's like, no, we've got 5. So do you not get more points or more? But you'd already, I don't know, it was just this.
Yeah, okay.
Generally, as an industry, we do like to implement what is visible and what can give you an indication that your building is sustainable rather than what is invisible, which is probably what matters.
Yep.
But isn't that the architect's role?
There is a little bit of a
but
like balance.
That should be to somewhat in the architecture and it's just another layer of non-essential paperwork that becomes a barrier to actually then building these buildings because people then design and add these things into it for the wrong reason. They're adding it in to tick the government tick box to get through council rather than building that's actually going to matter and last.
Yeah, look, I think if the solution was easy...
It is easy, though.
Yeah, I just disagree. I think it's hard. That's why people like you
exist. Do you think it's an easy solution?
Look, I think there is competing priorities. Obviously, NATO's passive house, you build your passive house, it's going to be very energy efficient, comfortable and whatnot. But it doesn't consider a lot of the other sustainability initiatives or implementation that you can do. It doesn't think about upfront carbon. It doesn't think about sustainable transport, waste management and all of that. And that's important as well.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where local governments in Victoria are trying to play a role in. They understand the knowledge there is a national construction code. Everybody needs to adhere to that if they don't want to go to prison. But then there is something that can be done a bit better.
You said if you don't want to go to prison, if you build incorrectly, you're not going to prison. You might get slapped with a, hey, don't do that again.
Yeah, well, yeah.
My thinking is these poor roadblocks along the way lead to poor outcomes, because if they're doing that, oh, I'm not going to write about that, where I don't know how I'd word this.
Well, I mean, I've just drawn something on my notepad here and I'm like, put passive house in a bubble and I put star ratings in a bubble and I put waste in a bubble, and it's like they're almost operating individual to one another. And is that where, say, someone like you in your ESD consultant role tries to then bring it all together in a logical way?
Yeah, there is a little bit of that. Yes, absolutely. It is a balancing act. It is trying to, you know, if I think that the perfect example is daylighting, which is something that council, especially in the residential, multi-story
yep.
residential space or commercial space, they really look for, and thermal performance. There is obviously a tension between the two. You yep. either achieve one or the other. It's difficult to achieve both.
Because shading?
You're shading, yep. your window-to-wall ratios and yep. all of that. So, yeah, our role is to try and find a perfect mix of initiative that work for local governments or the authority that needs to tick the box, but also for the client and for the design intent.
What's the perfect building then look like? You get a blank piece of paper. How would you, from a sustainability perspective, and the word sustainability is so different, it's like this jigsaw puzzle. What is it? You're doing it.
I think that you ask anyone in the team here and they will have a different yeah. response.
But what's yours?
I'm very much, well, obviously coming from Europe and Switzerland. If you've ever been to Switzerland, you'd see those buildings. They basically square boxes.
Yep.
Modest window-to-wall ratios and
thick walls.
Thick wall. I'm not saying that those are the perfect buildings for every
They're built for that climate. Yeah.
And they are simple. They do their job. Like the floor plates, they make sense. I look at floor plates sometimes. Yep. On the project that I work on here, and I go like, gee,
this is where that friction exists, though, because you know, in my view, I think architecture plays such an important role in our built environment because it needs to be aesthetically pleasing. We just don't want to walk down the street and just see these monotonous boxes everywhere.
I agree.
We don't want to see that. So this is where I think it's really important to blend the two together and make, as Liam was saying before, like consider compromises. And I think that's a really great term because you can't just say, well, we're going to do this because it looks great. You go, okay, well, let's unpack it a little bit and let's fine tune it so it gets the best of both worlds.
Builders, architects, let's be real for a second. We've all seen what happens when a cheap wrap fails. The callbacks, the moisture damage, the headaches. For me, wrapping a house with Proclimate is a non-negotiable of any build we do. It's about building tight, ventilating right. And when you use Proclimus tapes and membranes, you're giving your client a premium watertight envelope that prevents the building from moisture issues. It's faster to install, tougher on site, and it means you can walk away from a job knowing that the frame is protected for decades. Don't cut corners on your envelope. Visit proclimber.com.au today or head to the Instagram page at proclimber.au. So then what's the part that you argue about what's most important? What do you think is the least important that we worry about that we just why bother? We have a conversation, like what's the most over greenwashed then sustainability aspect?
Oh, gee.
It's all right. You're on camera. Yeah. You got it recorded.
I'm going to have lots of enemies here by the end of this.
Let's just say this is your opinion, right? Because we've all got different opinions here.
It's fact.
Look,
we're going to cut this up as a little snippet of ours.
Yeah. And we're going to cancel you.
Look, I think, if we think about design outcome, I find that when there is a tension between thermal and daylight, I think daylight is not necessarily important in bedrooms inside an apartment. Yes, I know, I understand where it comes from. It comes from those old, very small designs, maybe bedrooms without windows, and totally understand that we want to avoid that. But I think that as long as every room in an apartment has a window, you don't need to achieve high level of daylight. You can go outside to have daylight when you are inside a house.
You're sleeping. Like, does it matter?
For me, that's probably.
I agree.
I reckon that's that topical. Give me something spicy.
when we're specifically talking about, and I just want to go on the record here saying we're specifically talking about multi-res apartment style buildings. If we're talking about a single home, that's a completely different conversation, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about an apartment where we desperately need these buildings, we desperately need them to be thermally comfortable and efficient, and we desperately need them to be healthy. If the trade-off of that is that there's one room with good light and then your bedroom's a bit darker, fucking carry on.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah.
So if the same question then to a residential setting, is it the same concept? We just worry about too much light in a bedroom?
No, I don't. Probably not to the same level. And to be honest, like a single residential home is unlikely to have to go through this level of scrutiny from a sustainability point of view. It's generally just your NATUS ratings and off you go.
And you've got good experience in NATUS too. Like you that was your job for a while.
Absolutely. I'm not sure what would be in the residential space. So
can I then ask one question? Sorry, I'm jumping in here. Because NatHERS, how long did you do NatHERS stuff for? A few years?
I started a long time ago. I can't even remember, but that was probably the 2012.
So you were pretty embedded in, like, NatHERS was the solution, and you get Passive House.
Yeah.
What's better?
Oh, look, they do different things, but obviously as a design tool, Passive House obviously wins hands down, and that's not to say that is the only tool that is from a design point of view is good to use, but certainly it's up there.
What does NatHERS do that Passive House then doesn't do, and it does well? Like, where does that beat Passive House?
Well, NatHERS or the Hero software or the software that are using NatHERS, they're there to compare Apple with Apple and demonstrate compliance with code, and that's really about it. There is nothing else. There are differences, like, you know, the NatHERS software use hourly data, the PHPP use monthly data, I think that you can't really compare the two. I don't think it's unfair.
They're looking at different things, though.
I know, but this is, we as an industry, we do, and this is where I want to get at. Maybe we shouldn't.
Well, what do you mean?
Like, we all are Passive House versus NatHERS. It's like
they're different things.
I've been that person.
Everyone knows that I'm a Passive House and high performance builder. I would say 100% of our homes are getting modelled. Even our renovations are getting modelled in PHPP. But, you know, I'm obviously part of Sustainable Builders Alliance as well, and Jeremy Spence is a big advocate for the star rating, and he's been using the information that he's getting out of that modelling really well for a number of years. So I think, you know, this is not a poo-pooing on stars or NatHERS or whatever. I think both are really valuable. Like, modelling, regardless of what it is, let's just be agnostic for a second, is really important regardless of which pathway you're doing, but use it not just as a box checking exercise, use it as an optimization tool. So there's a massive difference between that.
So this is what I wanted to sort of, where I was hoping we would potentially get to, is that we're obviously very biased to Passive House. Yeah, I kind of wanted to jump onto the train of, like, what does it do better, and I wanted to argue the opposite side for once.
Yeah.
The PHPP does a much more precise job at working out the energy consumption of the building. There is much more inputs into it. NatHERS, it's really just concerned with the thermal envelope if you want. There is a lot of assumptions that are not current anymore, and you know there is a big research piece that is currently underway.
Yeah, Liam was telling us about that, which sounds super exciting and relevant. So I actually feel like that tool is going to become much more powerful and much more relevant.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And also, this was a couple of years ago, I went to a conference and a researcher from, I think, it was a university up in Queensland, he compared the PHPP with the native software. And when you can actually put in the same assumptions, and you need to have special
access to the back end. Yep.
But the results are very, very similar between the two.
And would the biggest one be the air change assumption?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, the, I think, is it, and you, what's the assumption that NatHERS makes for air change? Is it seven?
Yeah, it depends a little bit because it changes depending on pressures, wind pressures and all of that. But, yeah, you can probably assume that averaging like seven thereabout.
You know, with my house, it went from something like 8 to like 9.6.
If you put in the inputs for...
Yeah, we're able to just change the... it might be... point or two off here, but like that's roughly it actually made a huge change.
And I think that's a point that's probably the point I was trying to make before is like we choose to do passive house because we think right now it's much more impactful for what we're trying to achieve, but they're looking at different things. You can't compare. They're not an apple and an apple. It's a watermelon and a freaking orange. Like
the only beef I there's two beefs I have with NatHERS is one doesn't have airtight. Like imagine how cool for holding people accountable for the way we build.
Oh, 100% agree.
At the end of the project, go back to the NatHERS assessor, do it, and then all of a sudden, like, hey, this is what we got above. That's one part. The other part that I don't like, and it kind of goes, you're comparing apples with apples, but you're not, because a 6-star house in Melbourne is not a 6-star house in Sydney. So it's kind of contradictory to that.
Yeah, there is a whole... again, back end of star bands and heating and cooling loads, which is, to my understanding, a lot is based on economic feasibilities of achieving the star ratings.
And you also do Woofie modelling as well. So for those who have no idea and have been living under a rock, what is Woofie? What is a Woofie analysis?
Yeah, essentially, Woofie is a software.
Yeah.
The agrothermal analysis is essentially a study of a building assembly, whether it is like a wall, a roof, or a floor, and how moisture and heat travel through that assembly, through the different components, and the idea behind is to evaluate whether there are risks in that assembly and how big those risks are.
Hamish, can you do me a favor and tell me what Woofie stands for?
Oh. Yep. Okay. Warme und feuchte Istaschnia.
Sounds Russian more than German.
do you not understand? Do you not? No.
Oh no. You can ask Marcus.
Oh yeah. Along with Rames and the bus.
So it's a hydrothermal analysis. So basically, it's looking at the risk of condensation mold in a building.
Literally. Did what I got a report from Cam this morning on it.
And it's, you know what, like I feel I'm much more interested in that now as we as a business are kind of not pivoting, but we're opening up different offerings to work on existing buildings. And I know you're doing
it's a
similar
minefield.
Thing. And believe it or not, like, well, one, we've got how many millions of homes that need retrofitting, right? But there's going to be a huge problem if all of a sudden we're just, oh, we'll slap insulation in there and make it more airtight, right? We're actually creating a huge problem. However, we've got these softwares and modelling and people like yourself who can actually theoretically, and I'll say that theoretically because you've still got to have someone that's going to execute at the other end, theoretically prove or analyse the changes that you're making to that building. Is it going to be safe? So I'm super interested in this stuff now because, you know, we want to start targeting much more of this sort of retrofit market. Are you finding that you're doing more of that stuff now than you were before, or is there becoming more of an interest, or are you still in that kind of new space, new building space?
Yeah, it it's probably a little bit of a new thing, especially in the commercial space. There are some clients that are interested in, and you know, the way we approach it really in our day-to-day consulting is that obviously, if we just think about Section J reporting,
What is Section J reporting?
The energy efficiency reporting for compliance with the code.
Yeah,
you know, it's similar to your energy, similar to NATER's rating.
Okay, but this is for more commercial buildings.
Yeah, this is for commercial buildings. But so essentially, because we work a lot in commercial.
Yes, yep.
So the way we sort of go about it is that when we review a set of drawings with a wall type, with a roof detail or whatever, if we see an issue or if we think that there is an issue with the assembly, we talk to the client about it, and then we start to educate them on what the risks are and what can be done and how we can help. But there is still little understanding, little knowledge. We don't have many clients coming to us for, can you do an agrothermal model on this?
And it's not the answer. Like, I've got a project I'm probably banging Cam's head against the wall with right now, but it's not the answer. It's just going to give you risk.
That's it.
And that's what I think I'm only learning is, like, I would just go get a Wolfie model on it. But no, that's not giving me the answer. It's just determining the risk associated with the build-up that I'm going to potentially look at.
Oh, so it's telling you that there's a problem but not the solution.
Yeah, so Cam, for example, is telling me at the moment this setup will have a relative humidity of 81% and this setup will have a 90%. So it's pick your poison kind of thing. I still don't understand what that kind of means either. Like, I'm only quoting what he said, and it's like practically like you're trying to choose the lesser of the evils here,
yeah,
of your risks. And it depends on how you identify risk. Is it a mold index of 3? Is that your risk? Is your risk a mold index of 5? Like, what do we?
Yeah. Can you maybe talk to a little bit about that, the humidity? Like, what are we deeming safe? When we're looking at this model and the results from it, what are we deeming as safe?
So essentially what the National Construction Code deems acceptable is a mold growth index of 3, which essentially it's a measure of how much visible mold you can see with the naked eye on a 1x1 section of your studied area, or how much you can see by microscope, because obviously
how much you can see of what though?
Of mold spores.
Yeah, okay.
But is there a magical humidity number when you're looking at that?
No, not necessarily. It's not about the humidity.
Humidity gives moisture to, say, a cellulose material that could be trapped by moisture, which then is going to drive the chance of a dry rot or a mold.
Yeah, so you're looking at the risk of condensation within the...
Yes, exactly.
And it probably it differs because, correct me if I'm wrong, and I could be...
It's super technical,
So the humidity can change as it goes through layers?
Yeah.
Yep, so then it might just get to a point where there's a problem.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And is a mold index of 3 even safe?
That's the thing.
And
it probably all depends as well, like on the person, because some people are much more susceptible to mold than.
So one of the options, I'll be here totally not. We've got a double brick house. We're going to build a 90 mil frame in it. One of the options we checked is like the most cost effective and easiest method, tried and tested against the world, is just go spray closed cell spray foam in.
Mm, and then you're blocking any.
Environmentally, just let's remove any of those questions because it's not a water blown agent. And foam can be considered evil, and I just ignore that for a second. But there was still a chance that it could go wrong. So now we go, well, is that the best solution?
Mm.
And then you start to go, well, I don't want to be – like we've seen in the UK at the moment with all the foam issues, and I know that's a separate issue in roofs and stuff, and I still have a HRV, and I go back to this risk profile is like I don't want to be left holding the can as the builder here. Even though, so I can go to the design team, they can specify it, we can get the modeling done. It says we're safe, but the NCC is like, well, a mold index of 3 after how long? Like, what if it's going to get worse? What if we test and it's now 3 and then it's 5? Are we now in trouble?
And also, what if it's occupier issue?
Yeah, I've got a HRV, I've done everything above the code.
And then what if the client's for whatever reason, turn the HRV off?
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is, you left holding the bathwater here and you go, well, what risk do I want to take? The question I literally asked the question, am I best just putting in glass wall with a frame and whacking some plasterboard I'm building to the absolute code? Because if you thought in the court of law, if they're like, well, you introduced Intello, well, that's a different building material. You kind of knew about this. Why didn't you do?
You're also the expert too.
Yeah, I know. This is the hard part. Like you, so you lose either way now.
Yeah.
So you're trying to improve the efficiency of the building, and it's just retrofits are the scariest building. Like if you building new is easy, like so simple. Retrofits, and we've got a lot of.
But I love solving the problem though. Like I think that's what
brain.
That's
what's
exciting. I love it.
Yeah, and that's I often say like. Well, you need your A team to work on retrofit buildings.
Yep. So you need more than your A team. Anyone
can do like new builds.
Yeah,
you need more than A. I literally asked the question to our Hogwarts builders group of 10 builders of like, what would you do here? And there was vast different opinions and questions and more questions and the questions then lead to more questions. And
yeah, well, I think about the fact that we've got this group of people that actually can offer advice to that. Like as I was reading through it, I was in the middle of cooking dinner, so I couldn't really respond too much. But the fact that we've got this group of people who have experienced stuff and they've modelled stuff and they can put in some answers, like that didn't exist 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I just want to just with the Wolfie stuff and again, I kind of want to just bring it back to park life for a second. What are some of the things that you're kind of modelling using hygrothermal analysis in a building like that?
Well, essentially, we model deconstruction assembly.
Yeah.
So obviously, we put in the layers or you know whatever materials we're using, and that's one probably the first problem that we have in hygrothermal modeling using Wolf is that we rely on a database of products which have specific characteristic in terms of how they behave from a moisture point of view, from a thermal point of view. What is then installed might be different from what have we modeled as a product, and therefore our result will be different.
Yeah.
So that's the first.
And I'm sure that's not going to happen at Parklife though.
Did you run Wolfies at Parklife?
Yes.
Yeah. What did you run?
That's kind of what I was asking before.
Yeah. So what we run essentially is the wall assembly. Because we started from a rain screen facade as our perfect ideal situation, obviously a costly exercise.
Pro Climber have just brought out a new rain screen system this week, I think.
I saw that,
A plug there, Pro Climber.
Pro Climber plug.
We then move on to an insulated panel facade, so... think of your Kingspan insulated facade or Huskin insulated facade.
Like a bond door kind of type, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
From there, because we had our target for high NATOS ratings, we had some insulation on the inside of that insulated facade with some hair gaps and then the internal lining. We identified that internal insulation could create problems because then depending on how much insulation there was, the inner face of the insulated panel could become cold and therefore at risk of condensation. So we ran a few tests on how can we deal with that risk.
Not too much insulation on the inside of the airtight barrier?
Well, the airtight barrier was one of the... where do you put your head? Exactly. So, in theory, the insulated panel becomes your thermal, hair barrier, water barrier. Everything is in that layer. Everything is there. When we introduce insulation on the inside of that panel, then we introduce the risk of condensation on the inside face.
And that's for
because
and
that's a metal.
So it's going to, and that will condensate.
Yeah.
And is that moisture moving from inside out?
Inside.
And metal's got a zero perm too, so no water is going to transfuse through that.
Yeah.
So then we tried products to stop vapor moving from inside to outside. So an air barrier, a vapor barrier on the inside.
Intello from ProClimber.
Yeah. Yep. You can say that. as an option. Sure. Yep. That works. Still risk because it works in the model where we assume a perfectly installed Intello.
Yeah.
But a commercial builder installing perfectly Intello layer, it's almost impossible, I would say.
Yeah. Is it though?
No, it's not. But you know.
Yeah, but I've had a number of these conversations with Liam before, and I guess this is where people like us, or I'm not saying you or me, but just people like us in the resi space who have done the air tightener stuff forever and a day, or for the last 5 or 6 years, could come in and help educate these builders.
Yeah.
Like, I'd love to do that, because then look at the impact we're having. We're upskilling these people that are building effectively 60 homes at once.
If I was a young kid getting into industry, I would just become an airtight wrap specialist.
Honestly, I thought you were about to say become a big scale developer, like, because it's easy to finance your company whenever
you're imagine this, like, you're a young kid. I want to get into the industry. Might not do carpentry. I'm just going to be an airtight specialist. Think about the amount of work you could get from that.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Like, yep. Across residential and commercial. Like, there's just, it will be a job in 10 years.
So to bring it back to your home, you didn't end up building the house that Matt set out to build, but you built a little pod.
Yes.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about
process of.
In the process of? Oh, well, you're an owner builder, so it's an ongoing process.
What's the pod for?
So, the pod started as almost like a granny flat, if you want.
Yeah.
That was the initial thinking. Essentially, a room with a small kitchenette and a bathroom for us to have it as a study. But also for when we have people coming over and staying with us, because we don't really have the space inside the main house. So that's where we started. Obviously, budget hit us there as well.
Yeah.
And now it's simply a room. It's simply a 10 square meter
room,
which is gonna be a study, and perhaps a playroom for the kids or something like that. So very modest.
Are you certifying it?
Nah.
No.
I did model it in the Easy PH, obviously you guys know small buildings, small volumes, it's extremely difficult to get to passive house certification or level. But we got to the low energy,
PHR low energy. That's still pretty good though. Yeah.
But you've also retrofitted your existing house, and you've got a brick veneer. Us?
Yeah, we've done a little bit of work.
What have you done, knowing what you know? So it's probably good, two parts is, what have you done? And now knowing what you know, what wouldn't have you done?
So what we've done, the first thing that we've done when we moved in is we blow in insulation into the wall cavities.
Mm-hmm.
We put new insulation into the roof space, PV panels, rainwater tank. That's the first thing that we did when we moved in.
And would you do that again now? So the reason I say, if you're someone listening, want to retrofit your house, like, are they the easiest go-tos that you would do again?
Look, again, it comes back to budget. That's what we could afford, and that was the easy thing. I do it again now, knowing what I know? I would probably maybe see if I can get a bigger loan and actually do a bigger retrofit that looks at the whole house as a whole. Because obviously, we touched on before, you start to introduce an insulation into wall cavities, into roofs, you change the way the house behaves, and it can create problem. Now, I think that my house is relatively leaky, so even if we put in a little bit more insulation, it's not, it hasn't created an issue. And in fact, since then, we have changed built-in ropes, and so we pulled out plaster on external walls, and there is no sign of mold or humidity or condensation, so fairly safe. But can it create problems? Sure.
Yeah, the reason I asked is, like, because the reality is that is the situation of most people, is I want to improve the energy efficiency on my home. I don't have the budget to do much. Like, where are your starting points? Because my advice is like,
draft proofing.
Yeah. You get too airtight.
Well, I disagree. Like, if you are looking at the absolute bottom of the tree, it's lowest cheapest. Hanging fruit. Go to Bunnings, spend a couple hundred bucks, draft proof your windows and doors.
Silicon
because I guarantee like you are losing so much air. And I wouldn't think that you would get it that airtight that it's going to be a problem.
No, I agree. And the other one I would just go straight to is get some external awnings over some windows.
Yep, external awnings. But even, I mean, I know this is probably not what we said to talk about, but PV and electrify your home and go to heat pump ACs.
Yeah, and I think you've said before a number of times, like the electrification doesn't have to happen overnight. Like it just means as if your
one
cooktop dies, change it to an electric. If the gas hot water applies, change it to a heat pump. Like just
although
do them.
Although Tim Forsey did say something else, you guys just fucking send it and just do it all. But
I actually agree. But not everyone. Sometimes we live in a bubble.
I did say that to him. Great conversation. And we kind of went everywhere then. We have a segment on here called the MEGT Mindful Moment. And today I want to kind of go back to a topic that we touched on before, and it's apprentices remaining curious and curiosity. We've talked about PHPP today. We've talked about Wolfie. Our star rating. We've talked about Wolfie. Now, Wolfie, let's maybe kind of park that over here for a second, but your star rating and your PHPP, if you're building with a learning from high performance builder, exists in pre-construction. Ask your boss to have a look at it and ask your boss to talk you through it, because that understanding of why we're doing something will then relate to the practicalities of why so the theory behind, you know, what you're trying to achieve and the practical side of installing a window well, really well insulating and wrapping a building well. Like this is dictating the outcome of what you're doing on site. So just have that curiosity and just go and have a look at it.
Agree. Rob, if you could change one thing in the whole building design community world, what would you change?
Oh, you asshole.
I'm gonna start asking some hard I've got this idea of asking some really hard questions, the last question now.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanna leave it on some spicy notes.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I will change or implement is mandatory hair tightness testing as part of your building permit requirements.
Yeah, and it's a good, easy, low-hanging fruit one.
So, and you know what? Super cost-effective, $1,500. Cheaper if you go through Drew. but you know, like that is such a from a client's point of view, from a builder's point of view, knowing what your air tightness is massive.
Yeah, I think that's a great one. I think sometimes we try to get too technical with that answer, and we try to solve the world with one thing, but what I love there is you pick just one little tiny component and gone for it. So Rob, thank you. Need to go on to Hit V Hype. Is it hitvhype.com? All kinds of ESD, passive house, just really building up the industry to do better things. So thank you for so much for your time today. We really appreciate
there
it.
There's some things that I wanted to talk to you about, which you didn't get a chance to. Maybe that was
what
the,
is it?
Maybe this next one. Oh, just the government funded buildings that are coming out that you're working on and all that kind of stuff. But maybe that's a topic
for
another time when maybe they've rolled out and you can actually talk about it more, because
sounds good.
I'm super interested and excited the fact that the government's investing money in this stuff.
But we have to. Don't take your hat off to them. Like, well, you should, but like, we should be doing this. We need to.
Okay, I know we're digressing.
We need
to
do this.
I'm about to wrap this up. But like, the government is championing and fucking shouting from the highest building these big roads that we're building, but they're not talking about these homes that we're building. Anyway,
that's a great way to finish it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.